I was about to say that it was odd that he had been at Slosa's last night and not at Yeggie's today, when I saw that in the light of our brief morning interview, it wasn't very odd. Yet even the idea that he was intentionally keeping away made me uncomfortable. "They found him," said Cheskis, resettling his broad hips on the cushioned seat, "over in the south side in a glue factory, or a fish cannery or some such place, and gave him a hand out of the gutter. Some of the open trade crowd, I mean. Of course, he was useful to them when he was in the Kyoremi and Prime Minister, so they stand by him now. Mainly they do it to annoy Merson, I think. Merson's a spy for Tibby, and of course he thinks nobody knows it, but everybody does. And he can't stand the sight of Harth, thinks he's either a traitor or a double agent, and doesn't know which, and can't risk Shifgrathor and finding out. Which do you think Harth is, Mr. Cheskis? A traitor, Mr. I, pure and simple. Sold out his country's claims in the Sinneth Valley in order to prevent Tibby's rise to power, but didn't manage it cleverly enough. He'd have met with worse punishment than exile here. By Meshi's tits, if you play against your own side, you'll lose the whole game. That's what these fellows with no patriotism, only self-love, can't see. Though I don't suppose Harth much cares where he is, so long as he can keep on wriggling towards some kind of power. He hasn't done so badly here in 5 months, as you see. Not so badly. You don't trust him either, eh? No, I don't. I'm glad to hear it, Mr. I. I don't see why Yeggie and Obsol hang on to the fellow. He's a proven traitor, out for his own profit, and trying to hang on to your sledge, Mr. I, until he can keep himself going. That's how I see it. Well, I don't know that I'd give him any free rides, if he came asking me for one. Cheskis puffed and nodded vigorously in approval of his own opinion, and smiled at me, the smile of one virtuous man to another. The car ran softly through the wide, well-lit streets. The morning snow was melted except for dingy heaps along the gutters. It was raining now, a cold, small rain. The great buildings of central Mishnori, government offices, schools, Yomish temples, were so blurred by rain and the liquid glare of the high streetlights that they looked as if they were melting. Their corners were vague, their facades streaked, dewed, smeared. There was something fluid, insubstantial, in the very heaviness of this city built of monoliths, this monolithic state which called the part and the whole by the same name. And Cheskis, my jovial host, a heavy man, a substantial man, he too was somehow, around the corners and edges, a little vague, a little, just a little bit unreal. Ever since I had set off by car through the wide golden fields of Orgrin 4 days ago, beginning my successful progress towards the inner sanctums of Mishnori, I had been missing something. But what? I felt insulated. I had not felt the cold lately. They kept rooms decently warm here. I had not eaten with pleasure lately. Orgata cooking was insipid. No harm in that. But why did the people I met, whether well or ill-disposed towards me, also seem insipid? There were vivid personalities among them, Obsol, Slos, the handsome and detestable Gom, and yet each of them lacked some quality, some dimension of being, and they failed to convince. They were not quite solid. It was, I thought, as if they did not cast shadows. This kind of rather high-flown speculation is an essential part of my job. Without some capacity for it, I could not have qualified as a mobile, and I received formal training in it on Hine, where they dignify it with the title of far-fetching. What one is after when far-fetching might be described as the intuitive perception of a moral entirety. And thus it tends to find expression not in rational symbols, but in metaphor. I was never an outstanding far-fetcher, and this night I distrusted my own intuitions, being very tired. When I was back in my apartment, I took refuge in a hot shower, but even there I felt a vague unease, as if the hot water was not altogether real and reliable, and could not be counted on. Chapter 11. Soliloquies in Mishnori. Mishnori, Strethsusmi. I am not hopeful, yet all events show cause for hope. Absal haggles and dickers with his fellow commensals. Yegi employs blandishments. Slos proselytizes, and the strength of their following grows. They are astute men and have their faction well in hand. Only 7 of the 33 are reliable open traders. Of the rest, Absal thinks to gain the sure support of 10, giving a bare majority. One of them seems to have a true interest in the envoy, Commensal Ithapan of the Inyan district, who has been curious about the alien mission since, while working for the SARF, he was in charge of censoring the broadcasts we sent out from Erenrang. He seems to carry the weight of those suppressions on his conscience. He proposed to Absal that the 33 announce their invitation to the starship not only to their countrymen, but at the same time to Karhide, asking Argovan to join Karhide's voice to the invitation. A noble plan, and it will not be followed. They will not ask Karhide to join them in anything. The SARF's men, among the 33, of course, oppose any consideration at all of the envoy's presence and mission. As for those lukewarm and uncommitted whom Absal hopes to enlist, I think they fear the envoy, much as Argovan and most of the court did. With this difference, that Argovan thought him mad, like himself, while they think him a liar, like themselves. They fear to swallow a great hoax in public, a hoax already refused by Karhide, a hoax perhaps even invented by Karhide. They make their invitation, they make it publicly. Then where is their Shifgrathor when no starship comes? Indeed, Genli Ai demands of us an inordinate trustfulness. To him, evidently, it is not inordinate. And Absal and Yegi think that a majority of the 33 will be persuaded to trust him. I do not know why I am less hopeful than they. Perhaps I do not really want Orgeron to prove more enlightened than Karhide, to take the risk and win the praise, and leave Karhide in the shadow. If this envy be patriotic, it comes too late. As soon as I saw that Tibby would soon have me ousted, I did all I could to ensure that the envoy would come to Orgeron, and in exile here, I have done what I could to win them to him. Thanks to the money he brought me from Ashi, I now live by myself again, as a unit, not a dependent. I go to no more banquets, am not seen in public with Absal or other supporters of the envoy, and have not seen the envoy himself for over a half month, since his second day in Mishnori. He gave me Ash's money as one would give a hired assassin his fee. I have not often been so angry, and I insulted him deliberately. He knew I was angry, but I'm not sure he understood that he was insulted. He seemed to accept my advice despite the manner of its giving. And when my temper cooled, I saw this and was worried by it. Is it possible that all along in Erenrang he was seeking my advice, not knowing how to tell me that he sought it? If so, then he must have misunderstood half, and not understood the rest of what I told him by my fireside in the palace, the night after the ceremony of the keystone. His Shifgathor must be founded and composed and sustained altogether differently from ours. And when I thought myself most blunt and frank with him, he may have found me most subtle and unclear. His obtuseness is ignorance. His arrogance is ignorance. He is ignorant of us, we of him. He is infinitely a stranger, and I a fool to let my shadow cross the light of hope he brings us. I keep my mortal vanity down. I keep out of his way, for clearly that is what he wants. He is right. An exiled Karhidish traitor is no credit to his cause. Conformable to the Argata law that each unit must have employment, I work from 8th hour to noon in a plastics factory. Easy work. I run a machine which fits together and heat bonds pieces of plastic to form little transparent boxes. I do not know what the boxes are for. In the afternoon, finding myself dull, I have taken up the old disciplines I learned in Rotherer. I'm glad to see I have lost no skill at summoning Dathi's strength or entering the untrance. But I get little good out of the untrance, and as for the skills of stillness and of fasting, I might as well never have learned them, and must start all over like a child. I have fasted 1 day now, and my belly screams. A week? A month? The nights freeze now. Tonight a hard wind bears frozen rain. All evening I have thought continually of Estra, and the sound of the wind seems the sound of the wind that blows there. I wrote to my son tonight a long letter. While writing it, I had again and again a sense of Eric's presence, as if I should see him if I turned. Why do I keep such notes as these? For my son to read? Little good they would do him. I write to be writing in my own language, perhaps. Harahad Susmi. Still no mention of the envoy has been made on the radio, not a word. I wonder if Genli I sees that in Orgrin, despite the vast visible apparatus of government, nothing is done visibly, nothing is said aloud. The machine conceals the machinations. Tibby wants to teach Karhide how to lie. He takes his lessons from Orgrin, a good school. But I think we shall have trouble learning how to lie, having for so long practiced the art of going round and round the truth without ever lying about it or reaching it either. A big Orgata foray yesterday across the E. They burned the granaries of Tekember, precisely what the Sarf wants and what Tibby wants. But where does it end? Sloes, having turned his Yomesh mysticism onto the envoy's statements, interprets the coming of the Ecumen to Earth as the coming of the reign of Meshi among men and loses sight of our purpose. We must halt this rivalry with Karhide before the new men come, he says. We must cleanse our spirits for their coming. We must forego Shifgathor, forbid all acts of vengeance, and unite together without envy as brothers of one hearth. But how until they come? How to break the circle? Gurney Susmi. Sloes heads a committee that purposes to suppress the obscene plays performed in public kemmer houses here. They must be like the Karhidish Huthuth. Sloes opposes them because they are trivial, vulgar, and blasphemous. To oppose something is to maintain it. They say here all roads lead to Mishnori. To be sure, if you turn your back on Mishnori and walk away from it, you are still on the Mishnori road. To oppose vulgarity is inevitably to be vulgar. You must go somewhere else. You must have another goal. Then you walk a different road. Yegi in the hall of the 33 today. I unalterably oppose this blockade of grain exports to Karhide and the spirit of competition which motivates it. Right enough, but he will not get off the Mishnori road going that way. He must offer an alternative. Orgrin and Karhide both must stop following the road they're on in either direction. They must go somewhere else and break the circle. Yegi, I think, should be talking of the envoy and of nothing else. To be an atheist is to maintain God. His existence or his non-existence, it amounts to much the same on the plane of proof. Thus, proof is a word not often used among the Handarata, who have chosen not to treat God as a fact, subject either to proof or to belief. And they have broken the circle and go free. To learn which questions are unanswerable and not to answer them. This skill is most needful in times of stress and darkness. Tormenbad Susmi. My unease grows. Still not one word about the envoy has been spoken on the Central Bureau radio. None of the news about him that we used to broadcast from Erenrang was ever released here. And rumors rising out of illegal radio reception over the border and traders' and travelers' stories never seem to have spread far. The SARF has more complete control over communications than I knew or thought possible. The possibility is awesome. In Karhide, King and Kyoremi have a good deal of control over what people do, but very little over what they hear, and none over what they say. Here, the government can check not only act, but thought. Surely no men should have such power over others. Shuskis and others take Genli Ai about the city openly. I wonder if he sees that this openness hides the fact that he is hidden. No one knows he is here. I ask my fellow workers at the factory. They know nothing and think I am talking of some crazy Yomesh sectarian. No information, no interest, nothing that might advance Ai's cause or protect his life. It is a pity he looks so like us. In Erenrang, people often pointed him out on the street, for they knew some truth or talk about him, and knew he was there. Here, where his presence is kept secret, his person goes unremarked. They see him, no doubt, much as I first saw him, an unusually tall, husky, and dark youth just entering Kemmer. I studied the physician's reports on him last year. His differences from us are profound. They are not superficial. One must know him to know him alien. Why do they hide him, then? Why does not one of the commensals force the issue and speak of him in a public speech or on the radio? Why is even Obsol silent? Out of fear. My king was afraid of the envoy. These fellows are afraid of one another. I think that I, a foreigner, am the only person Obsol trusts. He has some pleasure in my company, as I in his, and several times has waved Shifgrathor and frankly asked my advice. But when I urge him to speak out, to raise public interest as a defense against factional intrigue, he does not hear me. If the entire commensality had their eyes on the envoy, the SARF would not dare touch him, I say. Or you, Obsol. Obsol sighs. Yes, yes, but we can't do it, Estravan. Speeches on a street corner like some fanatic priest... Well, one can talk to people, set rumors going. I had to do something of the same sort last year in Erenrang. Get people asking questions to which you have the answer. That is the envoy himself. If only he'd bring that damned ship of his down here so that we had something to show people. But as it is, he won't bring his ship down until he knows that you're acting in good faith. Am I not, cries Obsol, fattening out like a great radio. Printed bulletins, scientific periodicals, they're all in the SARF's hands. What am I to do, make hobfish? Haven't I spent every hour of the past month on this business? Good faith. He expects us to believe whatever he tells us, and then doesn't trust us in return. Should he? Obsol puffs and does not reply. He comes nearer honesty than any Orgata government official I know. Adgethany Susmi. To become a high officer in the SARF, one must have, it seems, a certain complex form of stupidity. Gaum exemplifies it. He sees me as a Karhidish agent attempting to lead Orgrin into a tremendous prestige loss by persuading them to believe in the hoax of the envoy from the Ecumen. He thinks that I spent my time as Prime Minister preparing this hoax. By God, I have better things to do than play Shifgrathor with scum. But that is a simplicity he is unequipped to see. Now that Yegi has apparently cast me off, Gom thinks I must be purchasable, and so prepared to buy me out in his own curious fashion. He has watched me, or has had me watched close enough, that he knew I would be due to enter Kemmer on Pasthi or Tormenbad. So he turned up last night, in full Kemmer, hormone-induced, no doubt, ready to seduce me. An accidental meeting on Pinefan Street. Hearth, I haven't seen you in half a month. Where have you been hiding yourself lately? Come have a cup of ale with me. He chose an alehouse next door to one of the commensal public Kemmer houses. He ordered us not ale, but life water. He meant to waste no time. After one glass, he put his hand on mine and shoved his face up close, whispering, "We didn't meet by chance. I waited for you. I crave you for my Kemmering tonight. And he called me by my given name. I did not cut his tongue out, because since I left Esther, I don't carry a knife. I told him that I intended to abstain while in exile. He cooed and muttered and held onto my hands. He was going very rapidly into full phase as a woman. Gom is very beautiful in Kemmer, and he counted on his beauty and his sexual insistence, knowing, I suppose, that being of the Handara, I would be unlikely to use Kemmer-reduction drugs, and would make a point of abstinence against the odds. He forgot that detestation is as good as any drug. I got free of his pawing, which of course was having some effect on me, and left him suggesting that he try the public Kemmer house next door. At that he looked at me with pitiable hatred. For he was, however false his purpose, truly in Kemmer and deeply roused. Did he really think I'd sell myself for his small change? He must think me very uneasy, which indeed makes me uneasy. Damn them, these unclean men. There's not one clean man among them. Adsorni Susmi. This afternoon, Genli I spoke in the hall of the 33. No audience was permitted and no broadcast made. But Absol later had me in and played me his own tape of the session. The envoy spoke well, with moving candor and urgency. There is an innocence in him that I have found merely foreign and foolish. Yet in another moment, that seeming innocence reveals a discipline of knowledge and a largeness of purpose that awes me. Through him speaks a shrewd and magnanimous people, a people who have woven together into one wisdom a profound, old, terrible, and unimaginably various experience of life. But he himself is young, impatient, inexperienced. He stands higher than we stand, seeing wider. But he is himself only the height of a man. He speaks better now than he did in Erenrang, more simply and more subtly. He has learned his job in doing it, like us all. His speech was often interrupted by members of the domination faction, demanding that the president stop this lunatic, turn him out, and get on with the order of business. Commensal Yemenbey was most obstreperous and probably spontaneous. "You don't swallow this, Gitchy-Mitchy," he kept roaring across to Absol. Planned interruptions, which made part of the tape hard to follow, were led, Absol says, by Kahasaril, from memory. Alshul, presiding. "Mr. Envoy, we find this information and the proposals made by Mr. Absol, Mr. Sloth, Mr. Ithban, Mr. Yegi, and others most interesting, most stimulating. We need, however, a little more to go on." Laughter. "Since the King of Karhide has the vehicle you arrived on, locked up where we can't see it, would it be possible, as suggested, for you to bring down your starship? What do you call it?" "Aye. Starship is a good name, sir." Alshul. "Oh, what do you call it?" "Aye. Well, technically, it's a manned interstellar Cetian design Nophil 20. Voice. "You're sure it's not St. Pethage's sledge?" Laughter. Alshul. "Please. Yes. Well, if you can get the ship down onto the ground here, solid ground, you might say, so that we can, as it were, have some substantial voice, substantial fish guts." "Aye. I want very much to bring that ship down, Mr. Alshul, as proof and witness of our reciprocal good faith. I await only your preliminary public announcement of the event." Karharasil. "Don't you see, Commensals, what all this is? It's not just a stupid joke. It is an intention, a public mockery of our credulity, our gullibility, our stupidity, engineered with incredible impudence by this person who stands here before us today. You know he comes from Karhide. You know he is a Karhidish agent. You can see he is a sexual deviant of a type which in Karhide, due to the influence of the dark cult, is left uncured, and sometimes is even artificially created for the foreteller's orgies. And yet, when he says, 'I am from outer space,' some of you actually shut your eyes, abase your intellects, and believe. Never could I have thought it possible," and so forth and so forth. To judge by the tape, I withstood jibes and assaults with patience. Absol says he handled himself well. I was hanging about outside the hall to see them come out after the session of the 33. I had a grim, pondering look. Well, he might. My helplessness is intolerable. I was one who set this machine running, and now cannot control its running. I slink in the streets with my hood pulled forward to catch a glimpse of the envoy. For this useless, sneaking life, I threw away my power, my money, and my friends. What a fool you are, Theram. Why can I never set my heart on a possible thing? Odeps Suzmi. The transmitting device, Genli I, has now turned over to the 33 in Absol's care, is not going to change any minds. No doubt it does what he says it does, but if royal mathematician Schorst would say of it only, "I don't understand the principles," then no Argata mathematician or engineer will do much better, and nothing is proved or disproved. An admirable outcome, were this world one fastness of the Ahandara. But alas, we must walk forward, troubling the new snow, proving and disproving, asking and answering. Once more I pressed on Absol the feasibility of having I radio his starship, waken the people aboard, and ask them to converse with the commensals by radio hookup to the hall of the 33. This time Absol had a reason ready for not doing so. "Listen, Estravan, my dear, the Sarf runs all our radio. You know that by now. I have no idea, even I, which of the men in communications are the Sarf men. Most of them, no doubt, for I know as a fact that they run the transmitters and receivers on every level, right down to the technicians and repairmen. They could and would block or falsify any transmission we received, if we did receive one. Can you imagine that scene in the hall? We outer spacers, victims of our own hoax, listening with bated breath to a clutter of static and nothing else. No answer, no message. And you have no money to hire some loyal technicians or buy off some of theirs?" I asked. But no use. He fears for his own prestige. His behavior towards me is already changed. If he calls off his reception for the envoy tonight, things are in a bad way. Otterhead Susmi. He called off the reception. This morning I went to see the envoy in proper Orgata style. Not openly at Cheskis's house, where the staff must be crawling with Sarf agents, Cheskis being one himself, but in the street, by chance, Gam fashion, sneaking and creeping. "Mr. I, will you hear me a moment?" He looked around startled, and recognizing me, alarmed. After a moment he broke out, "What good is it, Mr. Harth? You know that I can't rely on what you say, since Eringrang..." That was candid, if not perceptive. Yet it was perceptive, too. He knew that I wanted to advise him, not to ask something of him, and spoke to save my pride. I said, "This is Mishinori, not Eringrang, but the danger you are in is the same. If you cannot persuade Absol or Yegi to let you make radio contact with your ship, so that the people aboard it can, while remaining safe, lend some support to your statements, then I think you should use your own instrument, the Ansible, and call the ship down at once. The risk it will run is less than the risk you are now running alone." The Commensal's debates concerning my messages have been kept secret. "How do you know about my statements, Mr. Harth?" "Because I have made it my life's business to know." "But it is not your business here, sir. It is up to the commensals of Orgrin." "I tell you that you're in danger of your life, Mr. I said. To that he said nothing, and I left him. I should have spoken to him days ago. It is too late. Fear undoes his mission, and my hope once more. Not fear of the alien, the unearthly, not here. These Argata have not the wits nor size of spirit to fear what is truly and immensely strange. They cannot even see it. They look at the man from another world and see what? A spy from Karhide, a pervert, an agent, a sorry little political unit like themselves. If he does not send for the ship at once, it will be too late. It may be already too late. It is my fault. I have done nothing right. Chapter 12, On Time and Darkness. From the sayings of Tulom, the high priest, a book of the Yomesh canon composed in North Orgrin about 900 years ago. Meshi is the center of time. That moment of his life when he saw all things clearly came when he had lived on earth 30 years, and after it he lived on earth again 30 years, so that the seeing befell in the center of his life. And all the ages up until the seeing were as long as the ages will be after the seeing, which befell in the center of time. And in the center there is no time past and no time to come. In all time past it is, in all time to come it is. It has not been, nor yet will it be. It is all. Nothing is unseen. The poor man of Shini came to Meshi lamenting that he had not food to give the child of his flesh, nor grain to sow, for the rains had rotted the seed in the ground, and all the folk of his hearth starved. Meshi said, "Dig in the stone fields of Turesh, and you will find there a treasure of silver and precious stones. For I see a king bury it there 10,000 years ago, when a neighboring king presses feud upon him." The poor man of Shini dug in the moraines of Turesh and unearthed where Meshi pointed a great hoard of ancient jewels, and at sight of it he shouted aloud for joy. But Meshi, standing by, wept at sight of it, saying, "I see a man kill his hearth brother for one of those carven stones. That is 10,000 years from now, and the bones of the murdered man will lie in this grave where the treasure lies. O man of Shini, I know too where your grave is. I see you lying in it." The life of every man is in the center of time, for all were seen in the seeing of Meshi and are in his eye. We are the pupils of his eye. Our doing is his seeing, our being his knowing. A hemon tree in the heart of Ornan Forest, which lies 100 miles long and 100 miles wide, was old and greatly grown, with 100 branches, and on every branch 1,000 twigs, and on every twig 100 leaves. The tree said in its rooted being, "All my leaves are seen but one, this one in the darkness cast by all the others. This one leaf I keep secret to myself. Who will see it in the darkness of my leaves, and who will count the number of them?" Meshi passed through the forest of Ornan in his wanderings, and from that one tree plucked that one leaf. No raindrop falls in the storms of autumn that ever fell before. And the rain has fallen and falls and will fall throughout all the autumns of the years. Meshi saw each drop, where it fell, and falls, and will fall. In the eye of Meshi are all the stars and the darknesses between the stars, and all are bright. In the answering of the question of the Lord of Shorth, in the moment of seeing, Meshi saw all the sky as if it were all one sun. Above the earth and under the earth, all the sphere of sky was bright as the sun's surface, and there was no darkness. For he saw not what was, nor what will be, but what is. The stars that flee and take away their light, all were present in his eye, and all their light shone presently. This is a mystical expression of one of the theories used to support the expanding universe hypothesis, first proposed by the mathematical school of Sith over 4,000 years ago, and generally accepted by later cosmologists, even though meteorological conditions on Gethin prevent their gathering much observational support from astronomy. The rate of expansion, Hubble's constant, Rurherich's constant, can in fact be estimated from the observed amount of light in the night sky. The point here involved is that if the universe were not expanding, the night sky would not appear to be dark. Darkness is only in the mortal eye that thinks it sees, but sees not. In the sight of Meshe, there is no darkness. Therefore, those that call upon the darkness, the Handarata, are made fools of and spat out from the mouth of Meshe, for they name what is not, calling it source and end. There is neither source nor end, for all things are in the center of time, as all the stars may be reflected in a round raindrop falling in the night. So, too, do all the stars reflect the raindrop. There is neither darkness nor death, for all things are in the light of the moment, and their end and their beginning are one. One center, one seeing, one law, one light. Look now into the eye of Meshe. Chapter 13. Down on the Farm. Alarmed by Estrovan's sudden reappearance, his familiarity with my affairs, and the fierce urgency of his warnings, I hailed a taxi and drove straight to Obsol's Island, meaning to ask the commensal how Estrovan knew so much and why he had suddenly popped up from nowhere, urging me to do precisely what Obsol yesterday had advised against doing. The commensal was out. The doorkeeper did not know where he was or when he would be in. I went to Yegi's house with no better luck. A heavy snow, the heaviest of the autumn so far, was falling. My driver refused to take me farther than to Shuskis's house, as he did not have snow cleats on his tires. That evening I failed to reach Obsol, Yegi, or Slos by telephone. At dinner, Shuskis explained, a Yomish festival was going on. The solemnity of the saints and throne-up holders and high officials of the commensality were expected to be seen at the temples. He also explained Estrovan's behavior, shrewdly enough, as that of a man once powerful and now fallen, who grasps at any chance to influence persons or events, always less rationally, more desperately as time passes, and he knows himself sinking into powerless anonymity. I agreed that this would explain Estrovan's anxious, almost frantic manner. The anxiety had, however, infected me. I was vaguely ill at ease all through that long and heavy meal. Shuskis talked and talked to me, and to the many employees, aides, and sycophants who sat down at his table nightly. I had never known him so long-winded, so relentlessly jovial. When dinner was over, it was pretty late for going out again, and in any case the solemnity would keep all the commensals busy, Shuskis said, until after midnight. I decided to pass up supper and went to bed early. Sometime between midnight and dawn, I was awakened by strangers, informed that I was under arrest and taken by an armed guard to the Kunderschaden prison. Kunderschaden is old, one of the few very old buildings left in Mishinori. I had noticed it often as I went about the city, a long, grimy, many-towered, ill-looking place, distinct among the pallid bulks and hulks of the commensal edifices. It is what it looks like, and is called. It is a jail. It is not a front for something else, not a facade, not a pseudonym. It is real, the real thing, the thing behind the words. The guards, a sturdy, solid lot, hustled me through the corridors and left me alone in a small room, very dirty and very brightly lit. In a few minutes, another lot of guards came crowding in as escort to a thin-faced man with an air of authority. He dismissed all but two. I asked him if I would be allowed to send word to Commensal Obsol. The Commensal knows of your arrest. I said, knows of it? Very stupidly. My superiors act, of course, by order of the 33. You will now undergo interrogation. The guards caught my arms. I resisted them, saying angrily, "I'm willing to answer what you ask. You can leave out the intimidation." The thin-faced man paid no attention, but called back another guard. The three of them got me strapped on a pull-down table, stripped me, and injected me with, I suppose, one of the veridical drugs. I don't know how long the questioning lasted, or what it concerned, as I was drugged more or less heavily all the time, and have no memory of it. When I came to myself again, I had no idea how long I had been kept in Kunderschaden, 4 or 5 days, judging by my physical condition, but I was not sure. For some while after that, I did not know what day of the month it was, nor what month, and in fact, I came only slowly to comprehend my surroundings at all. I was in a caravan truck, much like the truck that had carried me over the Kargav to Ruhr, but in the van, not the cab. There were 20 or 30 other people in with me, hard to tell how many, since there were no windows, and light came only through a slit in the rear door, screened with 4 thicknesses of steel mesh.